You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the February 2024 issue of Vanity Fair magazine, which features Simone Biles on the cover. This is Vanity Fair, Part A. Here's the editor's letter, with photograph by Mark Seliger, of Radhika Jones, editor-in-chief. Ever since she vaulted into the spotlight, I have found frequent joy in watching Simone Biles' gymnastics routines on video. Her beam sequences and tumbling passes rate as wonders of the modern world, and part of her gift is making even the most complicated moves, the ones so difficult that they're named after her, since she's the only one who can do them, look easy. I was ready to watch her performance at the Tokyo Games with the usual awe and admiration. Instead, we watched with those same emotions as she made the tough decision to withdraw when a case of the twisties caused her to lose her sense of orientation in space. The stakes couldn't have been higher, and it was impressive to see her choose to protect her physical safety and her overall well-being. In doing so, she executed yet another complicated maneuver, educating the public on the mental fortitude necessary to flip and turn in midair and then stick a landing, and emboldening other athletes to share their own experiences. Now, as Leah Faye Cooper writes, Simone is recovered and training hard in the run-up to another Olympic Games. The greatest competitor in the history of gymnastics, she truly has nothing to prove to anyone. It's all about the joy now, and we are here for it. Speaking of games, if your group chats are anything like mine, at least one of them is devoted to complaining about words missing from that day's edition of the New York Times Spelling Bee. Today, I struck out on Eventide. The Times Games portfolio, a set of interactive brain teasers built on the foundation of the crossword, has attracted legions of new readers, or in games parlance, solvers, to the publication, and as such has become a core part of its offering. We thought it would be fun to pull back the curtain on the approximately 100 people at Games HQ who are responsible for engineering our playtime. In reporting this story, Vanity Fair Charlotte Klein encountered some of the best titles in the media industry. Can I change my business cards to read Editorial Director of Games? Unearthed the term Hot Wordle Summer, may it always be thus, and discovered that Executive Editor Joe Kahn obsesses about being Queen Bee, just like the rest of us. I get that Eventide is arguably archaic, but still, maybe he could have a word with the Spelling Bee editor on my behalf. Here are some of the issue's contributors. Fred Richin, The Fog of War. In light of the Israel-Hamas war, writing this essay was particularly painful because the credible photograph, the fulcrum of my career, has been so undermined, says the Dean Emeritus of the International Center of Photography and former Professor of Photography and Imaging at NYU. Mike Toffanelli, late bloomer. With his unique brand of visual humor, the illustrator and party caricaturist wanted to convey irreverent fun and silliness in his imagining of Conan O'Brien, a staple of his late-night show, he says. Adrienne Raquel, Forever Simone, in a series of images inspired by the simplicity and chicness of the 90s, the bicoastal photographer and creative director wanted to not only celebrate Simone Biles as a brilliant Olympian, but also a trailblazer with a perspective rooted in nostalgia and fantasy. Leah Fay Cooper, Forever Simone. Before pursuing a journalism career, the Vanity Fair contributing editor taught high school English in Houston, so being back in the city to interview Simone Biles was a homecoming. Her story could not be more inspiring, she says. Daisy Prince, Barbarians at the Glades. The former Vanity Fair London staffer and current editor of the Digital Party, a newsletter about the people and pivots of the 2020s, says Palm Beach is attracting an outsized amount of global attention. It's in transition, and we don't know what the next 10 years will bring. Andrew Buss, late bloomer. I thought about doing this oral history on Conan O'Brien for years. It's an epic underdog story that is truly one in a billion, says the L.A.-based journalist and Andy Kaufman historian. His new book, Top Five, published by Applause, about the making of the film High Fidelity, is out now. Open Book. On stage and screen, Renee Rapp plays a queen bee. In real life, she's more a Janis Ian type. By Britt Hinemuth. Renee Rapp's parents wanted her to go to college. She wanted to be a pop star. After detours to Broadway, where she played Regina George in Mean Girls, and Max, starring in Mindy Kaling's The Sex Lives of College Girls, Rapp is doing just that while keeping her options open. She's also Regina in Tina Fey's Mean Girls musical movie, now in theaters. "I thought that I was a horrible actor," says Rapp. "I thought that I was terrible at songwriting. And now those are the two things that I'm effing doing." Born in North Carolina, any person who's sort of translucent, I'm a descendant of, Rapp was raised by parents who owned a music store. After 3 seasons on Sex Lives, Rapp left to pursue a solo career, amid rumors that certain cast members had questioned her bisexuality. "The people in my life that I work with now care about me as a person," she says, "and I think that is a difference from things I've experienced in the past." She learned she'd play Regina once more at a point where she felt jaded and really angry and sad and bullied. "I was like, I hate the industry." When Faye offered her the role, it was really exciting. "I have a new start." Rachel McAdams, the original big screen Regina George, is her North Star, but Rapp's take on the character is a little different. "I'm a serial flirt, so I'm flirting with everybody, especially the girls, right? I have a bitchy attitude, so I'm going to be bitchy. I also am very dry, so she's going to be dry." As for Faye, a lot of people talk about lifting women up and being an effing feminist, and behind the scenes it's really not that. "And I think that Tina is exactly as good of a person as she is hilarious and intelligent. She's keen to move from comedy to more intense projects and would literally beg on hands and knees to play Stevie Nicks. Right now, she's touring her debut album, Snow Angel, in Europe. People are very sexy. I love a little accent. And reflecting on her past, I was told, boys aren't going to want to be around you if you're this emotional. And I'd be like, well, awesome. There's a strong chance I won't want to be around a boy. So go F yourself. Now this from Laura Regensdorf. Cult classics. Prada Beauty looks to the future while mining the house codes. Nusha Prada likes to play the contrarian, a one-time communist presiding over a fashion conglomerate, a designer whose notion of sexy tips toward ugly chic. So it goes that a woman known for wearing little discernible makeup is launching exactly that, with Prada Beauty now making its stateside debut. The product line hit the Milan runway last September. Is it by turns practical, eccentric, militaristic, and oriented for utmost care? Yes, to all. The refillable eye palettes are for archive buffs. Each takes after a Prada textile, translating retro prints into rich shadows. Metal-clad lipsticks come in two matte variations. The lip balm is tinted the house's mint green. Foundation, attuned to undertones, lends an unfussy polish, while the adaptogen-boosted skincare lineup, cleanser, essence, serum, cream, is as future-forward as Ms. Prada herself. After all, getting older allows for ongoing evolution. As she once put it, you gain some wrinkles, but finally, you learn to have fun. Foil Me Once by Daisy Shaw Ellis, with photograph by Horacio Salinas, low pleated fan bracelet in sterling silver. Perhaps no one in fashion more wholeheartedly embraces the art of collaboration than Lowe's prolific creative director, Jonathan Anderson, who in his 10 years with the brand has brought on such disparate partners as On Running and Paula's Ibiza. For his spring-summer 2024 show, Anderson worked with American artist Linda Binglis, known for her abstract sculptures and three-dimensional paintings, to create substantial bracelets, molten earrings, and climbing ear cuffs. The result? High-impact silver and gold-plated pieces that look variously like surrealist interpretations of pin-tucked pleats, hand-worked clay, and in this case, a heavy metal concert. Now, here's what's trending. Solid principles. Chase off winter doldrums with a palette plucked from the canvases of Durin and Matisse. Marmalade polos, Vert satchels, a timepiece in rich plum. They weren't called Le Fauve, wild beast, for nothing. In the photo, André Durin's fishing boats, Couleur, 1905, at the Museum of Fine Arts. Houston's Vertigo of Color, Matisse, Durin, and the Origins of Fauvism, from February 25th. Wild Thing, Max Mara dress, U-Beauty plasma lip compound in Shanghai, Risa earrings, Dior men shirt, Ferragamo bag, Hermes bag, high sport pants, David Yurman ring, about face, matte fluid eye paint in Crocodile Rock and Taxi Driver, Gucci skirt, Valentino jacket, Omega watch, Wear Sunny SPF 40 serum, Manolo Blahnik shoes, and Eric's bra. Thank you. Salon Culture, a Met exhibition on the impact of the Harlem Renaissance, illuminates a link between beauty pioneer Madame C.J. Walker and contemporary art by Andriana Campbell Lefleur. In the photo, Madame C.J. Walker's beauty salon, photographed by James Van Der Zee in 1929, and also a painting by Jessica Spence, shows a young girl having her hair braided. A 1911 photograph shows Madame C.J. Walker in the driver's seat of an automobile portering a car full of women, a veritable metaphor for collective success. At the time, Walker had recently incorporated her hair care enterprise, which ultimately made her one of the nation's first black millionaires. As the Louisiana native later told Booker T. Washington, "I promoted myself into the business of manufacturing goods and preparations. I have built my own factory on my own ground." Walker trained hair culturist at the Lelia College of Beauty Culture, named after her daughter, Alelia, and brought the talented tenth of intelligentsia and wealth into her orbit. Renowned for their fantastic glamour, the two Walkers lived not far from the Rockefellers at their estate, Villa Loaro, in Irvington-on-Hudson, New York. After CJ's death in 1919, her two Harlem townhouses continued to thrive under Alelia as places for conversation about art, culture, and politics. Based on the Baroque-era gatherings of Madame de Pompadour of the famous steepled hair, the word salon carried a double meaning in Walker's beauty parlors. As seen in a 1929 photograph by James Van Der Zee, the clientele in kitten heels, bob cuts, and finger waves coolly converse over tea. This view of cosmopolitan life is one of many in the Harlem Renaissance and transatlantic modernism opening this month at New York's Metropolitan Museum of Art. Curated by Denise Murrell, the exhibition convenes the era's thinkers and visionaries. Marian Anderson, resplendent in red, painted by Laura Wheeler Waring, Zora Neale Hurston in a pastel by Aaron Douglas, Paul Robeson, immortalized in bronze, and Josephine Baker on film. Van Der Zee's roving lens is particularly attuned to the magnificence of African diasporic communities. A transgender person in a fur-trimmed ensemble evokes avenues for acceptance in the era, and the subdued scene at Walker's is just as central to the glitz. Beauty shops are a mainstay of neighborhood garrulity, sites for transformation where the fresh coif brings its own twist of renaissance. Carrie James Marshall's 2012 painting, School of Beauty, School of Culture, shows a salon at its most boisterous, where children play on the wood floor and posters of Lauryn Hill and Chris Ofili share space with advertisements for dark and lovely hair color. Hair is also a recurring topos in Jessica Spence's graphic vivid paintings. 6 Hours, 2017, shown here, alludes to a kind of durational performance that takes place in a braid shop in Westchester County, New York, just a short drive from Walker's Renaissance Revival manse, where the likes of Langston Hughes and W.E.B. Du Bois gathered. Spence, who notes Marshall as an influence, attended a 2019 salon, Encyclopedia in Brooklyn, where a new generation discussed the overlapping worlds of media, art, and culture. In a sense, it was a milieu that Walker herself would soon rejoin with the 2020 Netflix miniseries Self-Made, starring Octavia Spencer. The entrepreneur finally got the gleaming Hollywood treatment, and the stylist in Spence's painting, wearing her crystal-studded apron, does too. Keziah Weir writes on books, Speak, Memory. Two authors consider resilience in memoirs of mourning, one a divorce, the other a dear friend's death. John Donne wrote that no man is an island, Sartre that hell is other people, two ways of describing our intrinsic entanglement with each other, us humans. Leslie Jamison's Splinters, published by Little Brown, and Sloane Crosley's Grief is for People, published by MCD FSG, tender another two takes. In Splinters, Jamison braids the at times volcanic dissolution of her marriage, her overwhelming love for her infant daughter, even as she yearns to return to unfettered art making, and the memory of her parents' own split, turning a keen eye on how both she and her ex-husband foundered, offering grace for each party. In the droll and poignant Grief, Crosley, a Vanity Fair contributor, confronts two calamities that occur a month apart. A thief steals her jewelry, and her closest friend dies. What might seem like a conflation of disproportionate events becomes a bridge toward closure, or rather the understanding that closure is just a story we tell ourselves. Though it's loss that these books grapple with, the pages brim with life. Listen in. In Kylie Reed's Come and Get It, published by Putnam, a professor obsesses over the class dynamics of an undergrad dorm suite, and eavesdropping ensues. Here, Reed, also author of Such a Fun Age, shares her inspirations. Runaway by Larry Kygwin, 2008. After seeing this dance piece, which Reed calls a bizarre combination of animal-like behavior and rigid mannequins, in 2010, it stuck with me so much that she wrote a modern dancer character into Come and Get It. Knocking the Hustle by Lester Spence, 2015. The transformative, beautifully written book, specifically in its position against the political narrative of inevitability, informed Reed's shaping of one character for whom hustle is a cornerstone of her personality. Funny Games by Michael Haneke, 1997. Reed describes the film's egg scene as a perfect example of characters breaking the rules of decorum, resulting in a fantastic low-level dread. Six-pack, twisty family ties, and vivid settings animate new novels. Martyr, in this intricately woven debut novel from poet Kaveh Akbar, parental history haunts a newly sober medical actor as he navigates a shifting relationship with his roommate and contemplates martyrdom. Published by Knopf. Greta and Valdin, quintessential rom-com meets the delicious family sprawl of a Russian classic in this portrait of two siblings navigating careers and love in New Zealand and beyond from Rebecca K. Riley. Published by Avid Reader. Antiquity, in Hermopolis, Greece, a lonely writer becomes engrossed by an artist and her teenage daughter. An hypnotic novel by Hanna Johansson, translated from Swedish by Kira Josefsson, published by Catapult. I Love You So Much, It's Killing Us Both. A friendship, a betrayal, and the aftermath play out from New York to Los Angeles in Mariah Stovall's emotionally perceptive debut, published by Soft Skull. The Storm We Made, Vanessa Chan's espionage-laden family epic, which takes place in Malaya under British and Japanese occupation, dissects the moral complexity of decisions made under duress. Published by Mary Sue Rucci. Ordinary Human Failings, Megan Nolan's taut story, oscillates between a reporter investigating an infant's suspicious death and the mother of a prime suspect. Published by Little Brown.
Thank you.
my stuff, field notes, from sculptural accessories to faux sheep, British interior designer Sophie Ashby revels in the unexpected. Style file, daily uniform, simple silhouettes from Jill Sander and a Metier handbag, to run errands, Prada loafers, wrist candy, anything from Alighieri. Heirloom, my engagement and wedding rings by Emma Clarkson Webb. On beauty, skin savior, Dr. Jart plus Sika Pear Sleep Air intensive soothing repair mask. No makeup, makeup, Shantikai Just Skin tinted moisturizer. Perfect application, Hourglass Cosmetics makeup brushes. To detangle, Hershishan's detangling brush. Perfume, Virial Georgette Eau de Parfum. Supplement, Wild Nutrition. Self-care, a deep tissue massage on the regular. For pleasure, listening to Sampha's new album, Lahai, inspired by the Royal Academy of Arts. Unwinding with Adam Buxton's podcast, He Always Makes Me Laugh. At home, recent edition, a Sammy Lynch painting. On display, a life-size faux sheep. Aroma, Moro d'Hebron herbarium candle. Paint color, pollen by Atelier Ellis in the dressing room. Lighting, Henry Holland Studio. Cushions, an afua in walnut from Sister by Studio Ashby. Glassware, Casa Rialto. Something sentimental, a painting my husband Charlie Casely Hayford made when he was 16. The menu, morning cup, rooibos tea with oat milk. Comfort food, baked beans and cheddar cheese on buttered toast. Sunday dinner, a roast chicken. Dining out at Spring in London, where my sister Rose works. It's all excellent. Travel, ideal stay, Monastero Santa Rosa Amalfi Coast. Long weekend, eating fish and chips on a cold beach. Luggage, July suitcase. To shop, Marché Opus de Saint-Ouen Flea Market for vintage furniture. Thank you. Bohemian Rhapsody at a jewel box of a hotel in Mexico City, Lush Pleasures Come in an Exquisite Package by Claire Howarth. In the photos, Pujol's signature dish comprises two moles, one fresh, the other aged more than 3,200 days. Orinardo perfume by Xinu with notes of muck orange blossom and Mexican tuberose. Vibrant handcrafts from locally woven textiles to stoneware at La Ciudadela. When real estate developer Octavio Aguilar saw the decadent Mexico City mansion at Luigi Urbano 84, home to only two families since it was built in the 1940s, he knew it would be a hotel. His hotel. Lodging had never been a part of Aguilar's portfolio, but he'd spent his whole life traveling around the world, developing a passion for boutique hotels along the way. One trip he took as a teenager with his mother and sister to France's Loire Valley was particularly foundational. They stayed in three smaller spots, he says, never needed a reservation, and the service was perfect and personal. When he got older, he'd flip through the Relais Chateau book to find the places he thought had the most character. And so Aguilar, who still calls his native Mexico City home, though he has properties in New York, Miami, and Madrid, brought to life the Casa Polanco, named for the posh neighborhood that sprang up with Spanish colonial revival flair at the same time the house did, all around the tidy, rectangular Park Lincoln, an easy stroll to the sprawling Chapultepec Park, one of the oldest urban green spaces in the world, at twice the size of Central Park. Casa Polanco took several years to design and renovate, including 2 years and 20 meetings, says Aguilar, to persuade the regulatory body at the Instituto Nacional de Bellas Artes to let him open such a business on a residential street front. Aguilar had already been waiting 8 to 10 years to deploy the stunning Irish green Italian marble in one of his projects. It's now the showpiece of the lobby and the color thread that brings the lush exterior foliage indoors, along with an arion tree rising through the center of the dining room. The 19-room hotel opened quietly in 2022, with a doting concierge to match Aguilar's Loire Valley memories and a bartender who serves Classe Azul on the rocks, Compri, in a library off the veranda. The full-service experience is quickly gaining ground on all sorts of best-of travel lists, especially as Mexico City enjoys a broader tourism boom. Aguilar is leveraging outside interest in his city to show off Mexican artists and artisans. The hotel is supplied and scented by Xinu, a local botanical perfumer. Their Flor de Moscow candle at $90 is how I'll hang on to my own memories of Casa Polanco. While curator Santiago Toca has filled Casa Polanco with sculptures by Rodrigo Garcia and paintings by Jordi Boldo. Each February, art-minded visitors can enjoy a 5-day visual feast throughout the city during Zonamaco, the biggest art fair in Latin America. Along with a promenade, walking helps you experience any city more. Aguilar recommends visitors explore Mexico City's culinary offerings. Some clear hits, the famed Jujol, a few minutes' walk from the hotel with a mole madre that's been simmering perpetually for at least a few years. In Roma, Elena Regades, named World's Best Female Chef of 2023, reigns supreme with Rosetta, featuring Mexican-infused haute Italian cuisine and yet another fantastical indoor arboretum, plus a bakery, Panaderia Rosetta, down the street. And on the tree-lined Avenue Alvaro Obregón, farm-to-table fare wins the day at Maximo Bistro, where the vibes are bustling and the cocktails are spiced to ambrosial perfection. Cups runneth over. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both Parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selections by Mark Hoffman.